Okay.
Chat. So we are here with today with Elpo Heikkinen. Is that how well did I do pronouncing that?
That's pretty good. It's Elpo Heikkinen.
Elpo Heikkinen.
Yeah, even better. Yeah.
It has a very nice lyrical. It's like fun to say.
Yeah. That's how Finnish uses it.
Finnish is all fun to say. Yeah.
Yeah. Complicated, but.
And you tell us a little about yourself.
You're here from
Finland?
I'm here from Finland. I'm a sound designer, artist, association active, audio engineer, all kinds of things. And I'm here in New York to work with my friend John Kors. Just getting a break from Finland and trying to see what's happening in New York and getting to know people and organizations and places. And
so you're not here for a specific project or a specific performance or presentation, but just kind of general soaking things up?
Yeah, soaking things and like soaking John all the time. It's like working with him mainly, but nothing like too specific.
And John, do you want to tell us about your background or?
I guess I'm an artist that works kind of with different digital medias, I suppose. I have a background in sound as well. I ran a mastering studio. I guess I still run it part time. And I teach at Pratt and just kind of do a range of different work.
And you have some radio background. We were both, talking about, both have a background in pirate radio. And
yeah.
You were in Colorado in the late 90s, is that it?
Yeah, from 96 to 2000. And in 96, as a freshman, we picked up an FM transmitter that was...
Who made it?
It was...
I know
I bought it secondhand.
Five transmitters at the time.
Yeah, right. It was... didn't Stephen Donner have one called the FM5? I remember the 5 somewhere in there. And yeah, it was this thing that was basically a board. It didn't have a case. And
so it was somebody made it. It was handmade rather than like mass produced?
Handmade as in somebody who made quite a few of these, but not mass produced. Yeah, and I didn't really know how to use it, so we fried it within a week. And then... Over time, got to know a guy up in the hills who kind of became our regular repairman, who then eventually upgraded it with actually a real case and then a fan.
I'm always interested in what was his background. Was he like an old shortwave guy, an old guy that worked at FM radio commercial stations?
Yeah, he was like a... So this was in Colorado Springs. And Colorado Springs is this big military town. They have a mountain there called NORAD that is hollowed out. And there's a lot of antennas around there. And so he was like an antenna technician, I guess. Worked for a couple of stations and an electronics guru who just moved up in the hills into a really small town and kind of ran this like odd electronics shop that had no hours really and sometimes took a month to get a hold of him.
And so he helped you guys learn how to work a transmitter?
Yeah, pretty much. I put an antenna on the roof of our dorm that we ran, up 4 or 5 stories up, and we were broadcasting there off and on for about a year, year and a half.
And what was the impetus for why did you want to start a pirate radio station?
I don't know. I guess I went to high school my senior year in London. And I think London had such a rich history of pirate radio and then, hearing about all the offshore stations. And I think that's really where I got interested in it. And then when I was in Colorado, I was doing a lot of research on what else was going on. And I kept hearing about this radio station called Radio 90. And they were playing a lot of music I was interested in at the time and seemed to be associated with a lot of really interesting projects. And I couldn't figure out for the longest time where they were located, and it was one of the first sort of retransmitters where they had. Are you familiar with Radio 90?
I know I'm not. That so is it a pirate station or a legal?
It was a pirate station that was in the Bow Valley, which was sort of nondescript. As I later learned, the Bow Valley is in Canada, and it's outside of Calgary. It's in Banff, and it was a project that Heath Bunting, had created that was kind of the first, at least that I'm aware of, retransmission radio, basically when that was right around when what did we call it back then? Digital radio, but there was another name for it. Streaming. It was like real
player.
Yeah, it was like when they first started, and so basically you could for the first time tune digitally into stations across the world. And so he had created this algorithm that would randomly pull stations and retransmit it. And then they had radio shows as well.
And you could hear them in Colorado all the way that?
No, because at that time I was on forums and the web was
just starting.
Yeah. And so a lot of it was still text based. And, I just kept hearing about this station. And at that time I wasn't really in tune with what was going on. So what I knew about was kind of the world of Stephen Dunifer and that world a little bit. And then what I found online, which is, and I guess I remember hearing your story about what happened in Florida briefly. So yeah, that was kind of a long-winded story of how I really got interested in it. And then I ended up spending a lot. Banff has this really phenomenal arts institution called the Banff Center they had an institution called the Banff Center for New Media, which is part of the Banff Center, which put out some of the books that you have in the library, like Radio Rethink and stuff like that.
And Elpo, was there pirate radio in Finland at this time, or is there now?
Not that I know of. Not too much. We had one project like with John teaching us at the Academy of Fine Arts in Helsinki. That was like one day radio thing, but there isn't a big scene for pirate radio in Finland. There should be, but there's not. It's so
nationalized. Is it because the licensed legal radio like? Is it good? Is there many different choices? Or are there just one source? Or what is it like?
It's going down. The National Broadcasting Company, WILE, has a couple of really good channels, but then and some like indie channels as well. But overall, the radio hasn't got its like the independent and like unofficial role back as you might have had in the US and UK or anything like that. So we're still waiting for that. I think there's like all kinds of small projects, but nothing really so stable as you guys have.
Is there any particular radio show or radio station in Finland that's particularly good or that should be mentioned?
I don't know. I always listen to the National Broadcasting Company's like speech radio. It's like programs about philosophy and like that kind of stuff. Nowadays they do sports as well, but it's like good combo.
But it's still talking about larger issues.
Yeah. And there's like really good programs over there, like local guys just speaking up, like politics and philosophy and stuff. So that's my favorite.
All right. And John, you also did another project called OMG TV. Is that what it's called?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that how you're supposed to say it, or are you supposed to...
Yeah, no, that's exactly how you say it.
Tell us what that was.
So that was a TV station that I launched in New York right at the moment that there was the digital transition, when analog TV stations turned off and switched fully to digital transmissions. And so basically anybody that hadn't bought an updated TV or hadn't bought a digital antenna basically was left without any TV. And so it was a little unclear about who knew about this, and there were a couple other issues.
So basically now if you have an old TV that's not hooked up to a cable or something that just still works on an antenna and you tune around the dial, all you hear is static now.
Right. Yeah. And what you're picking up are waves that have been bandwidth that's been reallocated predominantly to AT&T.
Unlicensed cell phone, Wi-Fi, or things like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's licensed. They purchase them, but yeah.
So what was that project? So what did you put on the air?
It was intended to be a TV station that went live, and that was partly community run, or it had community input, but at the same time was unlicensed. And so the input was designed to never actually have the full imprint of one person's decision. So at that time, it was kind of looking at the Pirate Bay philosophy, which is a BitTorrent site from Sweden, that where it's decentralized, and so no one person's actually responsible for breaking any laws because it's decentralized. That was kind of the idea I was playing with. That wouldn't necessarily hold up in court, but and so we had the station was actually on a the station itself was actually a server somewhere downtown that was licensed to some guy's cat, so that was untraceable. And then the transmitter would kind of move with me. So for a while, it was on the roof of IBM in Chelsea. I then moved it to Vancouver. I was invited to be part of the 2010 Olympics, and then in Banff as well.
And how far did the signal go?
It depended. It depended on basically how high I cranked the amplifier, and I went through a couple of
different
amplifiers.
I guess how high the antenna was too, right?
And how high the antenna was. Yeah, and I didn't have a very good antenna. The actual TV transmitter was built by Stephen Dunifer.
It was one of his first TV transmitters. I remember when he was working on those. So what year was this?
So this would have been 2008 when I started the project. I think he had kind of been doing them
for a couple years there. Yeah. I think that it's 2004 or 2005. I think I remember reading about the video transmitters are coming. Or
right. And so, I ordered
one.
How
well did they work? I never saw, I've never seen one.
I mean, the picture was pretty good. The range, like you asked, wasn't that great. It was 2 miles maybe. But again, based off of a series of input, antenna height and so forth. So it worked pretty well. But it gave me an absolute massive headache. And so I always struggled
from the frequencies, the radio waves were too close.
As soon as you hit that switch, I would just like get this like pulsing headache.
Really?
Yeah. So I kept having...
Have you ever felt that around any other electronic devices or just this transmitter?
Well, I felt that way also when I was in Finland and we rented a 1,000-watt transmitter.
Video transmitter or a radio?
No, this is a radio FM transmitter. And if I were to guess the cause of the problem, I think it's just using a very low-quality antenna. And then there's something being kicked back or...
spilling out or something, but it wasn't just you that was being affected by the waves, or was it everyone around that transmitter?
I mean, I was the one who was closest to it all the time. I think, did you notice it in Finland?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was,
And that again was, that was like a J-pole. And actually that was a more expensive antenna, but I originally had one of those copper antennas. That's the old J-pole antenna.
Do you know the Video Freaks story?
No, what's that?
Video Freaks was a group in late 60s and early 70s in New York, and the kids were all the rage that day. So CBS somehow they got CBS was said, well, you're going to be part of the CBS news team, and these young hippie freaks they gave them all this. It was they just made the camcorder, it just came out, the first mobile so they got all this equipment, and then they made this radical show that, of course, never aired, and they were never allowed to do anything after they saw what they were doing. But they somehow got to keep the equipment. I'm not sure if that was a legal or illegal way that they got to keep the equipment, but they ended up starting their own. They moved up here to about 10 or 15 miles south in the mountains from where we are right now to Lanesville in Greene County, and started a is maybe the first pirate television station in the country, and I think it was 1971 here in Greene County, with this equipment that CBS TV paid for, so there's all kinds of.
How long was that running?
2 or 3 years, I think, and they got the. It was basically the cable access model before there was cable access. They like invited the community in to come and do shows and you know, went out in the community because they had the mobile unit so they could go out and right. do things.
That's awesome.
Then the other story on that tip is not video related, but I always talk to other pirates. There was a, you know, the World Trade Center used to have an artist program.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And Stephen Vitello did a project up there and had a, I think, a 1-watt transmitter that could get to 23rd Street because it was that high.
Oh, wow.
So people could hear his, I think it was a 1-watt transmitter. And this is one of those fishtails. The transmitter power gets lower and lower in the farther, but
1 watt is legal. I think that's the cap.
It's all. I think it's very questionable. You know, they say the part 15, but part 15. I think anything you buy that's part 15 that says it's part 15 isn't right. quite really legal if you actually measure it. There, the part 15 transmitters I bought are all like I think they're more, but it's somewhere around there. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, it's interesting. I only knew about his project where he actually recorded. The grid or the whole like structure,
the building. So the, when it was wind, you could hear it. Yes.
Yeah.
But he, I think he was broadcasting that. Maybe that signal. So he would take that sound, and then that would what people would hear if they were in a cab, and the cab was listening to whatever number frequency he was on.
That's interesting.
I don't know if the, I don't think it's still on, but that there was this hip hop pirate that was on in New York for years and years, and they would only come on at 10 p.m. at night.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, I think it was every night. Some nights, sometimes I think it was just once a week or something. But they stayed on for the longest time. And they were on some incredibly tall building because I would drive around and I could hear it on the west side of Manhattan. I could hear it in Brooklyn. Most pirates in New York City don't go that far because there's so many tall buildings that
right.
Block the signals.
Where were they based? Were they mobile?
I think maybe they were on a tall Queens building. They were definitely on a tall building. I think maybe I heard Queens from people. And they were also, we got a transmitter because of them. I think it was because of them. Somebody else was using a transmitter on the frequency they were using in Dumbo. And it got, somebody kept cutting the wire from the transmitter to the antenna. And so the theory was that it was this other pirate radio station. But then they gave the
other transmitter. As in two pirate radio stations were jockeying for the same
frequency. Yeah, same frequency. Fighting over the same. The funniest New York story I have is the you know about the Hasidic. There's been many Hasidic pirate stations, but there's one case I found online where the Hasidics have this special court it's recognized legally, I don't know, but they family or group had this equipment for a pirate radio station that they were running, and they like went out of town, and the engineer they were working with like absconded with all the equipment and started the basically the same station but locked them out. And so they took them, the original people that owned the equipment, took them to this special Hasidic court to decide the matter about the pirate radio station. If you search this out, there's some long story in this Jewish journal or something all about this pirate radio case. And they actually, I think they ruled that they gave back the equipment to the original people. But
you were based in South Williamsburg, so presumably, did you hear any of those Hasidic stations?
Yeah, one time we had a our modus operandi was to like lend out the transmitter to different people, and so it would go to this person one weekend and this person one weekend, and we would just put flyers around the general area. And so one week we had a yard sale, I think, to raise money for the station at somebody's house, and so we put signs up saying there was a yard sale or stoop sale. It was a stoop sale, yes. So we said we're broadcasting from the stoop, and we said we had the things hanging out the window of the apartment and down on the street broadcasting. And this guy rides up on a bicycle and is like, "Are you guys the pirate radio station?" And we're always a little nervous when somebody arrives saying that. But then he explained that he had his own pirate radio station and saw the flyers, and it was a Hasidic gentleman who told us all about his station and how he was broadcasting like liberal news from Israel to the Hasidic communities there, and that the conservative members were giving him a hard time trying to get him off the air because he was giving this more pro-Palestinian view than...
So this was a deliberate political act.
Yes, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and the thing in Brooklyn, there's these huge groups of immigrants that don't have... any media of their own, you know. Right. So that's why there's so many Haitian stations. There's all those Haitian stations because there's no Haitian media other besides the pirate radio stations. And the Hasidic communities are so large that they're somebody's bound to start a electronic station, as you know, as well as text and things.
What do you know how involved the FCC was in trying to triangulate a lot of these stations?
The FCC only you know, reacts to complaints, basically. They're right. just overwhelmed, and they keep cutting their budget and their staff and everything. And so, you know, we, in our years in Brooklyn broadcasting, we got one visit that might have been considered an FCC. I don't know if it was an FCC visit. Somebody gave us a different transmitter, and we started using it on a Friday. And on Sunday afternoon, this guy... he was kind of Hispanic looking in a beat up old car with a red old baseball cap. I remember, rang the doorbell and, first he rang the neighbor's doorbell that's what he did. And he rang the neighbor's doorbell and then, saying, is there a pirate radio station here? Cause we had the antenna on the roof at the time. And
so he picked out the antenna from the street.
I'm not sure what is, how he got there, but the neighbors were cool and they knew about it. And so they said, I don't know anything about that. And then they called me immediately. And so I got, he rang our doorbell and then we didn't answer. And then I watched him out the window and he kind of like looked, see what was going on. And maybe he saw me looking at him or well, I don't know, but we turned off the transmitter right then.
Yeah.
And he went away and we never heard anything. Yeah. The only times basically, so he was probably another pirate. The only other people that ever visited us were other pirates.
Uh-huh.
The hip hop station or the, you know, people would find the station. And in Tampa, when we started too, we had it on a record store roof and this guy drives by one day and comes into the store and says, you guys have a pirate radio station here. And we're like looking at him, what is he talking about? Oh. And he's like, I work at 98 Rock and the commercial radio station. Right. And I have my own pirate radio station that I do on the side too. And he says, I know that's a radio antenna.
That's funny. Takes a lot of their way.
So the laws have beefed up lately because these state legislators have passed these laws saying that it's a crime to broadcast illegally in New York, Florida, New Jersey.
As in lately, as in after
the last
2008?
10 years? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the laws have passed, and I think they're all blatantly unconstitutional because the states don't have any jurisdiction over in the United States. Individual states don't have any jurisdiction over the airwaves. The federal FCC is the only body that regulates airwaves in this country. So the states passing laws about what you can do on the airwaves, I think, would be thrown out in a second. But now they go in with more SWAT teams in at least those three states.
Yeah.
But I mean, they only react to complaints.
But, I mean, that's one of the... one of the more interesting things about the FCC is that they actually don't have an enforcement arm. So they can figure out where the stations are, but then so my father was in the FBI for 25, 30 years, and so he kind of explained this to me this way, in that the FCC would have to reach out either to local law enforcement or to federal law enforcement, and if those places felt compelled to help, they would, or if the, you know, in the case of federal, if the crime was big enough. So you know, he had told me if, you know, if something above $30,000 worth of damage could be proven, then they would actually maybe go after something, but that was a rarity. And so I guess, yeah, I'm curious if you know of any stories where the actual federal law enforcement got involved, or if it's all just local police.
I don't know of any FBI or CIA.
CIA.
Well, yeah. I mean, the joke is, you know, that every time the United States does any military adventure overseas, the first thing they do is set up pirate radio stations.
Right.
They don't get there. Nobody gets approval from the government of Iran or Iraq or Afghanistan, but they set up radio stations, you know, for their own reasons or whatever. So there is that CIA involvement in pirate radio.
Right. Yeah.
What was the reaction to the OMG TV project, or could you tell if there was any?
That was really hard to gauge, and we were only up for a limited time. And you know, with the gift of hindsight, I would have planned out very specifically how to gauge community involvement. We could see certainly people being involved in the actual curation of the programming and picking of shows and the creating of shows, but we couldn't see of those people that could actually, you could watch it online as well. But we, from the actual analog transmission site, how many people were actively watching? And I guess that's also a very hard number to come by
if you're doing a regular radio, but if you're doing pirate radio or pirate television, it's even more difficult.
Right.
And especially if you're doing it after the dial goes blank.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I'm thinking of when I mention that is that we were near quite a few public housing buildings, and those would have been ideal locations to kind of reach out to help in curating programming, but also because those might be the populations that may be first affected by this digital transition.
It's the Mbana Kataka situation in Springfield, Illinois, where he's broadcasting to like 10,000 people in three giant housing projects for the last 20 years or something. 25 years, since 1987, I think. He's had the police shot through his window a couple times, I think. And they don't come to investigate that. And so he's had like battles with the city and stuff. But I think it's still going. Anyway, so explain what you two have been working on this week, or going to visit, or what have you seen or done, or what radio ideas have you talked about, I guess?
Well, actually, what I'm working on right now, and Opal has been helping me out quite a bit, is this feature film I've been working on for about 4 years. And the film is about the New Jersey Meadowlands, kind of sort of camping and exploring out there over 7 to 10 day trips, and kind of looking at the environment and how we perceive it and how that changes with kind of recovering wilderness areas and areas that have this sort of rich history of toxicity and waste. But the film is nearing completion, and so we've been spending a lot of time doing field recording, trying to capture some of the sounds of that area. And so we've been using this, it's a 4-channel microphone, but that has a decoder that then creates surround sound mix that you can then aim in a 360 degree direction if you're mixing down a stereo. And so we've been trying to get sounds that work for the film that are from that area. But the problem that we keep coming across is that the sounds, the blanket sounds of that environment that we've tuned out, overwhelms the whole recording. And so we've been unable to actually get the sounds that we perceive to be hearing when we're in that area.
You need some special filter?
Yeah, we've tried every imaginable filter, like white noise filters, or EQ, we need a content filter. We need a highway filter.
Highway and airplane filter.
We have with this road out here, we often have artists who want to do field recordings, visitor or in the residency program, and basically they have to wait till like 3:30 in the morning to get a 45-minute or half hour or maybe less moment when there's not a truck running down the hill or there's not a car.
Right.
But you can also make these great recordings. I got some of you can hear the truck like 5 or 10 miles away in the distance, and then it gets closer and closer and closer, and then it's overwhelming, and then it's going off in the distance.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of thing you're just too much of.
We want that because that's, of course, the environment, and that's really sort of the underlying narration of the film, are these juxtapositions of this sort of recovering wilderness area and then the city around it. But so trying to find that right balance and translating that to sound has been incredibly difficult, much more challenging than I ever imagined. I just figured we'd go out there with some mics, get that nice balance of highway and wildlife and call it a day, and it's been incredibly challenging.
So have you thought of a different way around it, or
yeah, I mean, we went further and further and further upriver. We started in Newark Bay and kind of worked our way all the way up, and now we're all the way up here. So we did a bunch of field recording on the way up here.
Yeah.
So that's kind of this trip was combining those two things in Harriman, State Park, and how did that go?
It was like almost too noisy still. although it's like a lot more quiet than
it was a great day, Jersey, but perfectly still.
Yeah.
And so there weren't the wildlife sounds that we were kind of looking for. And it was so quiet that all you heard was the highway 10 miles away. Oh. So
the preamp hiss.
Yeah. Yeah. So
we'll see.
Yeah. I'm not really sure where to take it from here, except
I guess it's different too when there's snow on the ground or snow falling that kind of eats up the sound.
Yeah. Snow falling. The lake was starting to freeze a little bit. It was gray, so
no leaves on trees. Anything like that.
Birds went south.
Yeah. The usual.
Winter isn't as good for probably.
I mean, I was thinking, you know, it's all nice and quiet here. This is perfect. But of course, there was nothing left except the highway.
And so you're leaving Sunday? Is that heading back?
Yeah, Sunday.
And what are you going to do what are your last couple days in New York like?
I don't know. It's going to be hectic, I think. I have a big list of all things that I want to be able to do, but I'm not sure. There's going to be work. Or like probably going to be helping out John as well. And like
doing some... going to be mastering a record on Thursday.
Yeah, well, that's that kind of stuff too. And then, I don't know, I still have some like really nice touristy stuff to be done as well. I want to go to Queens more. I haven't been to Bronx. I want to go to a church in Harlem, you know, the usual.
Sunday morning, maybe.
Sunday morning, yeah. And then off to your airplane, I think. Yeah. And maybe sleep at some point.
There'll be time for that in Finland, right?
Yeah, it's going to be the Christmas holiday, so I'll have a good time to sleep.
All right, well, we've been talking to Ilpo Hikkinen. How close did I get?
That was the closest.
That was the closest?
Yeah.
And John Kors from New York and Ilpo from Finland and visiting Wave Farm today. Thank you guys very much for coming.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. All right.